welcome to The Autograph with me, Susan Madaris. This week, I'm sitting down with author and professor Mustafa Bayoumi to talk about his recent work. Join us as we discuss one of the most shocking events of our time, the attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. On May 31st, 2010, Israeli commandos boarding from sea and air attacked the six boats of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla as it attempts to bring humanitarian relief to the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip. Within minutes, nine peace activists are dead, scores of others injured. The 700 people on board the ships are arrested, transferred to Israel, and then deported. In midnight on the Mavi Marmara, the attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla and how it changed the course of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Mustafa Bayoumi has compiled an extensive series of articles and essays from a range of activists, journalists, and analysts, which piece together the events that occurred that May night. Mixing together first-hand testimony and documentary record from those aboard the ship with hard-headed analysis and historical overview, Midnight on the Mavi Marmara reveals why the attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla may just turn out to be the beginning of the end for an apartheid Palestine.
Midnight on the Mavi Marmara is the first book about the attack on the Mavi Marmara, but it will likely not be the last. As Philip Weiss and Adam Horowitz write in their contribution here, the attack on the Mavi Marmara will probably be understood as this generation's anti-1967 moment for Israel. Immediately following that war, more than 40 years ago, Israel was seen by many in the Western world as the scrappy underdog beating the odds. Today, according to Weiss and Horowitz, that image is gone forever, and the ongoing siege of Gaza has caused many to consider what Zionism has built in the Middle East. In these pages, you will find testimony, analysis, history, and poetry from activists, novelists, academics, analysts, journalists, and poets, all of which tackle the events of that night and their meaning for the struggle for Palestinian rights, for the state of Israeli society, for American Zionism, for the history of the conflict, for the role of resistance strategies in today's world, and more. The attack on the Mavi Marmara is particularly significant because its impact will be felt along three significant and related lines, the understanding of which is necessary if we are to see where the Israel-Palestine conflict is headed and possibly find a way out of our current impasse.
Mustafa Bayoumi is professor of English at Brooklyn College, City University of New York. His writings have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, CNN.com, the London Review of Books, The Nation, and many other publications. Bayoumi's book, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America, won an American Book Award and the Arab American Book Award for nonfiction. He is also co-editor of the Edward Said Reader.
After the attack on the Mavi Marmara happened, I was shocked and outraged. I think many people around the world were shocked and outraged by it. And within days, another person was shocked and outraged by it. That would be Colin Robinson, who's the publisher of OR Books. Colin contacted me right away and asked if I would be interested in heading up a book that he called a quick book, if we could put it out really, really quickly in response to this attack. And that seemed like an interesting idea to me. It seemed like a way to try to establish a certain kind of, in fact, a narrative drawn from the participants of the flotilla, and allowing also some analysis to come forth, which often in situations like this is lacking. So I felt that a book like this could do a lot of good in that way.
You know, there is a deeper analysis that follows. There are articles and analysis put forth by many of your contributors in the book that put the situation in historical context. Why is it important to take a look at the situation from a historic standpoint?
Well, I think there's always a tendency within American culture, Western culture, cultures in general, I'm not sure, but there's often, if not always, this tendency to look at a crisis moment only in terms of the context of that crisis. But crises do not arise out of thin air. They obviously come out of something. And I think we have to understand the root causes of all kinds of crises if we really want to understand what they are and what the possibilities are for averting them in the future. So in this case, it seems to me that it's very important to understand not just what happened on the night that the flotilla was attacked, not just what happened since the the Operation Cast Lead, not just what happened since the election of Hamas in Gaza, not just what happened since the war of 1967, but really to go all the way back and to try to understand the root causes of the Israeli-Palestine conflict.
Contributors like Ben Sal, Rashid Khalidi, and Noam Chomsky put the situation and the attack on the Freedom Flotilla in historical context. Noam Chomsky writes that the background is important. Israel assumes it can commit such crimes with impunity because the United States tolerates them, and Europe generally follows the U.S.'s lead. At a recent conference on midnight on the Mavi Marmara, Noam Chomsky stressed that the U.S. government is equally at fault when it chooses to watch in silence Israel's violation of human rights.
A very elaborate hasbara system, you know, propaganda system that they have in Israel, and it's quite extreme. We don't have one here because we don't need it. Nothing's reported anyway without it. And that's a much deeper form of conformity and obedience, much deeper. Mustafa, I guess it was, read the commented on that Amnesty International report, one of 19 humanitarian organizations that commented on the, did a study of the alleged relaxation of the siege after the Mavi Marmara protests. And the AI commentator pointed out that there was, they said that the effect of the relaxation of the siege had was almost zero with regard to Gaza, but it did have one effect. It weakened the international protests against the siege. Now, he didn't add one important fact. It didn't weaken them in the United States, because there weren't any. The United States was off the spectrum on this. And that's a point to remember when there is a growing, anybody who's been involved in this issue for decades, as I have, knows very well that there's been a significant change in popular attitudes. Meetings like this used to be impossible. First of all, it would be a scattered audience. The meetings would be broken up. You have to have police protection. And not very long ago, on this campus, in fact, and elsewhere. It's changed in the last 10 years or so. There's now a much wider recognition among the public, not in elite sectors much. Don't see it in the media or commentary. But among the public, there's a much wider recognition of the ongoing criminality of Israeli crimes, of Israeli actions. And these particular atrocities, like the Mavi Marmara, they heighten it. They organize and extend it. And that's led to a big change. But I stress, Israeli actions. There's yet no breakthrough, detectable one, on what is much more important for us. These are not Israeli actions. They are U.S.-Israeli actions.
How would you say the attack changed the course of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as the title of your book implies?
Well, I do think that the most significant aspect of the Freedom Flotilla is the fact that it's really a rising up of global civil society activists really trying to take action in their own hands. Because the rest of the world community, especially the politicians, are not doing that. And I think that you see actually a growing history of that within the context of the Israel-Palestine conflict. You see a lot of internationals coming to work, for example, with the International Solidarity Movement, which does a lot of direct action to oppose the occupation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. You see a lot of other people also coming from across the world for the demonstrations in Sheikh Jarrah, which is one of the neighborhoods in Jerusalem. So I think that that's really an important point, and it's one to underline, that the conflict is being seen less and less as a conflict between just Israelis and Palestinians, or between Israelis and Arabs, and really more and more as a kind of global question of how can we move forward in the world. This is becoming too intractable, that it's really damaging the idea of coexistence, not just in that region of the world, but across many different corners of the world. I think we saw something similar in relationship to when apartheid in South Africa in the 1980s was seen as a curse on the world. There had to be a way that we can mobilize global civil society across the world to see that this will no longer exist. What I think the Freedom Flotilla represents is something similar. It's a sense that the intractability of the Israel-Palestine conflict must be done away with. We must get over it, and we must solve this conflict with justice and coexistence for all.
Within hours after the attack on the Freedom Flotilla heading to Gaza, outrage at Israel's actions echoed around the world. Spontaneous demonstrations were held in Europe, the United States, across the Muslim world, including Turkey, and Gaza itself to denounce the attack and Israel's siege on the Gaza Strip. Professor George Bisharat writes in the book, Israel's deadly attack on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla was flagrantly illegal. Bisharat puts the Gaza blockade into perspective. He notes, collective punishment is specifically barred under the Fourth Geneva Convention. Israeli officials have repeatedly stated that the objective of the blockade is to weaken the Gaza economy and undermine support for Hamas. This is a political, not a military objective, and it is impermissible under international law to target innocent civilians. Actions taken to enforce an illegal siege cannot themselves be legal. So I ask Bayoumi why he thinks international organizations and high courts have more often than enough chose to remain silent.
I think that the international community often lacks the courage of their convictions. And so there's obviously one of the most important elements of the Gaza flotilla and the attack on the flotilla really is that it was global civil society trying to step in where the international community of politicians has failed. You have a siege on the Gaza Strip, which is immiserating 1.5 million people and making their life conditions very, very difficult. And really, across the world, people see this as a violation of international law and as an act of collective punishment. In fact, many in the international community do as well. Many politicians in the international community do as well. But there's a lack of will to actually implement that. There's often a lack of will to implement justice within the international system, and it's a big problem. And the mechanisms that we have established that are attempted to be established, such as the International Criminal Court or the World Court at The Hague or various world tribunals, themselves are very quickly compromised by politics. I think it's a very important moment in global history that we really have to focus as a global community on questions of justice and not just questions of convenience for political gain. And I think that that's one of the lessons that we can hopefully take from the attack on the Mavi Marmara.
And what about after the attack? Has Israel been held accountable?
Not as of yet. After the attack, the United Nations Human Rights Commission investigated, and they interviewed many different people from many different countries and from many different continents. They had a rich investigation that came out quite very critical of Israel and said that the Israeli government was guilty of crimes here. And then the Israeli government published its own report. The Turkel Commission came out with their own report, in which they said that although the deaths did occur, the soldiers were acting in self-defense, so no crimes were committed. And this is part of the problem, is that there is no real mechanism by which to take these questions to an international hearing. Now, the Human Rights Commission report, if I recall correctly, does ask that this be pursued further. And there are venues such as the International Criminal Court or The Hague to pursue this further. And we might very well see that. These proceedings can take very long time. But as of yet, there has been no accountability for what happened.
Professor Noam Chomsky believes while there has been significant rise of public awareness throughout the years, anti-war and domestic support groups have become targets of FBI probing, notably under the Obama administration. Undermining the freedom of speech and other freedom of actions, making it difficult to express opposition to Israeli policies and support for Palestinians.
Not just that case. This is the first action taken by the FBI under a new Supreme Court ruling which was pushed through by President Obama. He's the one who pushed it through. It was argued by Kagan, his new Supreme Court justice, and they won with the support of the far-right justices. It's the worst attack on freedom of speech since the Smith Act in 1941. It criminalizes action, including speech, which the government claims provides support for organizations on the terrorist list. Now, first of all, the terrorist list has absolutely no justification whatsoever. It's an arbitrary list put together by the government, no review, you know, no evidence. They can put anybody they want on it. Ronald Reagan, for example, took Saddam Hussein off it because he wanted to provide him with aid and put Cuba in instead. They do anything they want. The terrorist list is a scandal, and Obama's making it worse by now saying that any kind of support, and that can be speech. In fact, in the case in question, particular case in question was a case of a legal aid group which was advising the Turkish PKK, which is on the terrorist list, of giving them legal advice and advising them on pursuing nonviolent action. That's giving them material support, and that's now criminal. It's a very far-reaching attack on freedom of speech and other freedom of action, and these raids are the first case in which the FBI is following those principles.
You know, after the tragic incidents that occurred on the Freedom Flotilla, reports started to surface in some media outlets that restrictions against Gaza were eased. How is the situation right now?
There was activities all across the world that said that this was unacceptable, from demonstrations and union activities and these sorts of things. So there was a lot of pressure put on the Israeli government to respond. And in one way, I think we could, at that moment, it seemed like that was part of the success story, that there is accountability if there's enough global pressure. And so immediately following, within, I forget exactly how long, but within a week or two following the attack, Israel announced that it was going to ease the restrictions on goods into Gaza. And so some saw that as a great victory. And if you didn't see it as a victory, then you saw it as, well, problem solved. However, many different organizations compiled a report that came out, I think, in January of this year. This was Amnesty International, Save the Children, a bunch of other organizations, if I recall correctly. And their report talked about, in fact, the failures of the easing of the sanctions. And the fact that even though there was a public relations coup around saying that the sanctions now had been eased on the Gaza Strip, that in fact the situation there was barely improved compared to what it had been prior. The number of trucks that are needed for growth and for, in fact, just still rebuilding from the destruction of Operation Cast Lead, is the number of trucks required is enormous, and the number of trucks that are allowed in is still very small. The number of projects that organizations like UNRWA or the UNDP, United Nations Development Program, can actually implement due to the lack of these resources coming into the country are almost insignificant. I believe that UNDP doesn't have enough trucks to implement a single one of their programs. There are many different examples of this. I think it's important, in fact, to try to keep a sense of what's going on in the Gaza Strip in order to understand the difficulties of life there. But it's sometimes difficult for people who are far away, since the world's attention can quickly get focused on other parts of the world.
How would you say the recent uprisings in the Middle East and North Africa will ultimately affect the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, more specifically the Palestinians?
Well, I think the most immediate effect that we might see is that I suspect that there'll be a lot of pressure on the border between Egypt and Gaza, that become a much more free and open border. Rather, you know, the siege on the Gaza Strip was enabled not just by the Israeli government, but also by the Egyptian government. But really, this was opposite to the will of the Egyptian people. the vast majority of the Egyptian people sympathize with the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza and feel that there's an act of collective punishment going on there. So I think it would be very difficult for a popularly elected government in Egypt to sustain that kind of sanction on the border. So I imagine that that'll be one of the most immediate changes that we will see. Beyond that, I'm not sure. I mean, I think that nobody really wants another war in the region. And so I don't think that we're going to see, there's a lot of fear-mongering going on in the United States right now that the Camp David Accord will be rescinded if there's a popularly elected government in Egypt, or especially if it's a religiously motivated government. And I tend to doubt that. I think that that people actually want to find less violent ways in the region, because the region is exhausted by war and conflict. I hope that I'm not proven wrong on that. I think that in one way, what it possibly could mean is that there'll be a greater dialogue and more sense of accommodation, perhaps coming from the Israeli government as well, as we all enter a new reality in the Middle East.
And do you think we're entering a new chapter in the Israeli-Palestinian standoff? And how do you assess Israel's relations with the rest of the world, with the international community?
Well, I think that within Israeli political society, and perhaps in Israeli society in general, it has shifted to the right. And that shift to the right has alienated a large number of people in the rest of the global community. Avigdor Lieberman is their foreign minister, and from what I've read in mainstream accounts in the United States, he's not very well liked in diplomatic circles around the world. I think that that's a very clear indication. That's one clear indication of this rightward shift within the Israeli political sphere. And so I'm not sure that that things are going to change on a dime, you know. And it does seem to me, though, important that we can find a way through dialogue, since there is really no military solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict, that we do find a way to resolve the conflict and move forward. I think that there's really no reason to keep this conflict going if you look at it from a sense of what is to be gained by solving this conflict. There's so much to be gained and nothing to be lost if the conflict is solved. And that's why I think it's really imperative that people of conscience all over the world try to work towards finding a solution. And that's what is most represented by the participants on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla itself.
Mostafa Bayoumi, thank you very much for joining us on The Autograph this week.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for this edition of The Autograph here on Press TV. Thank you for staying with us and watching. Remember, you can always send us your emails to theautograph@susanmadaris.com. We're always looking forward to them. Until next week in another show from all of us here in New York City, goodbye.